Blog Talk Radio.
The Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. Call in at 646-716-8652. And don't forget to push 1. Broadcasting from the southern plains of the greater Midwest in Kansas City, overlooking the beautiful Kaw River Valley in lovely Wyandotte County, Kansas, and occupied Osage Indian Territory. So greetings, ex-prisoners, partisans, communards, brigadiers, and lumpen proletariat. This is the Prison Abolitionist Hour podcast, celebrating 370 years of anti-capitalist thought through reasoning and rebellion. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. Tonight we have a broadcast from Final Straw Radio, Ashland, North Carolina, with Sophie Lewis and the Antisocial Family. We'll begin with the nuclear family and privatization, children and the disabled, and the movement for family liberation against capitalist privatization and alternatives to the patriarchal structure that we're seeing dissolved as a result of COVID-19. Music by Sepultura, a metal band from Brazil, from this summer's performance at Hellfest 2022.
The Final Straw is a proud member of the Channel Zero Network of Anarchist Podcasts.
You know, I was thinking, one of the things you say in the book that really struck me, you quote Margaret Thatcher's really famous claim that there's no such thing as society, only families and individuals. And from that claim, you make this your own claim, then that means that family is an antisocial institution, which I think at first would seem not right, because we have this idea that family is where we get our connections to, or we know we can connect with people, perhaps. But yeah, I think within that kind of phrase, there's something really interesting, especially like thinking about ideas of like social war. I wonder if you might unpack that idea about family as antisocial a little bit, which I guess would just expand on what you were saying.
Yeah, well, I'd love to take credit. It's really Michelle Barrett and Mary McIntosh with their title, The Antisocial Family.
Oh, right.
I think they wrote this. No, it's fine. I think they wrote this in 1982, 1984. I can't remember. But in any case, yes. They are in this kind of Thatcherite moment in the United Kingdom, and they are two Marxist feminists who are kind of refusing to go along with the generalized feminist strategy I mentioned earlier of pretending that family abolition was never dreamed of by anyone, apart from maybe some really crazy people. And they're sort of, yeah, they're holding aloft the, you know, the promise, the need, the orthodox Marxist imperative, really, although it's not like Marxists really took that part of the Communist Manifesto and honored it ever, but that's another story. But like, they say in their book, The Anti-Social Family, that as I read it, yeah, basically Margaret Thatcher says there's no such thing as society. There's only individual men and women and families. And they say, yeah, exactly, because, you know, of the last part, the first part is true. The fact of the family is what turns all of human life indoors into the domestic realm for private satisfaction. And so the social is kind of what happens on the opposite sort of end of that impulse. Right, it's when we cease to turn inward and meet one another in the commons. So the social is like starved systematically and structurally by the family, because the family is not just the narrative and the ideology, but also the material means you know, foretelling us that all the good feelings that we require, and all the very basic sort of functions that we require to be able to get up in the morning are located in the private nuclear household. They cannot be sort of generated together outdoors, right? And it's the competitiveness of the family, the sort of keeping up with the Joneses, chauvinism, us and them mentality, the kind of rat race mentality, the mentality you touched on earlier about like pure survival, like, you know, working for your entire life, you know, basically is easily recognizable as unbearable. And indeed, during the big quit or great resignation that people were talking about a lot last year, to a lesser extent, you know, recently, you know, people did start to sort of reach a kind of tipping point, you know, of saying like, well, actually, fuck this. But the thing that makes it very difficult to reach that point is, you know, the doing it for your children, the doing it so that your children can have a better life than you had. Or, you know, indeed, the doing it for your sick dad, your sick mom who doesn't have enough, you know, money to pay for needed medical care, so on and so forth, right? These are the reasons why it is the love of another, the love of family, that forces us into these sorts of deeply disempowered, you know, encounters with the labor market as a wage slave.
Final Straw is a proud member of the Channel Zero Network of Anarchist Podcasts.
Just some of the last things you said was making me think, because you brought up the Great Resignation, and I was thinking about COVID, how when the pandemic first hit, it really sort of brought home the insufficiency of the family as a location of care, especially for people who are like parenting or, like you said, you know, caring for disabled or ill family members, because most people still had to work in some way, but then they were also caring. Like, they didn't, their structures of care that they relied on, like school for children, weren't available. But it's kind of interesting. I was just thinking about how, you know, there was this huge right-wing reaction to that by trying to force this, you know, get the schools back open through like kind of like COVID skepticism or COVID denialism, which then turned into this whole like critical race theory and anti-gay and anti-trans movement against schools. And I'm wondering, like, if you have any thoughts about that, because, like, again, it's one of these experiences where, like, COVID hits and I'm like, oh, everyone's going to be face-to-face with the contradictions of the world that we live in, and they're going to be, like, have a fire lit under them to organize things that are better. And then we have this kind of, like, reactionary and really hateful outcome. Yeah, I just wonder if you have any thoughts about that, like why when faced with the insufficiency of family and the need for larger care structures, did it take such like a fascist turn?
Yeah, I mean, this is the question I'm kind of asking myself. I think it's a really important question. I've been listening to the Death Panel podcast and kind of going on that show a lot because I think they have such wonderful things to say, mm-hmm. you know, both about the sort of concrete kind of policy development that some of us, certainly I, find it quite difficult to follow, and they do that hard work, but then also the sort of, you know, the political and theoretical ramifications from a disability liberationist perspective. And I'm reading their book Health Communism to kind of try and find clues as to how, you know, historically critical utopianists sought to deprivatize care from a perspective of like anti-psychiatry and unionized sickness, right? Like the socialist patient collective in Heidelberg in Germany in the 1970s thought to, you know, quote unquote, turn illness into a weapon.
Something from an album which is called Chaos CD. This is about all the bullshit that they tried to push into our minds. This next song is called Propaganda.
Abolitionism is something that, you know, changes, you know, overnight, right? It's not like the world could be remade as a basis of, like, you know, state law, state discourse, architecture, things like the apparatus of custody, the apparatus of sort of like parental rights and so on, like all of that it's just so interesting how there was two things simultaneously going on, like an affirmation of the sort of the sanctity of family, the primacy of family, the need to sort of stay indoors, stay the fuck at home, and, you know, obviously some of us, you know, anarchists, utopians, like anti-capitalists, asking, like, who's home, you know? In what way can the private home under in private property, the very location where the vast majority of sort of sexual violence and for women murder occurs, how can you be forcing people into that space under the aegis of safety and wellness, right? people are going to explode in this pressure cooker situation. And indeed, you know, people were reporting that domestic violence rates were through the roof. People who were sort of battered or abused found it especially difficult to flee, you know, their partners or their abusive family members,
mm-hmm.
because there was an intensification of the, you know, the imperative to stay with your own, right? This idea of us and them is on one level really intensified under a lockdown. But then at the same time, this exactly kind of antagonistic moral imperative arises, you know, like, what about your neighbors? How are we going to make sure everybody's okay? You know, people are not okay, you know? And so all this kind of mutual aid was, you know, simultaneously kind of just made necessary, made really obviously necessary. It's necessary all the time, right? But, it, you know, COVID kind of like raised a little bit more awareness of it. I just don't know what the collapse was. I think there was a real sort of demoralization at one point. There was a real sort of a desire for the normal, which was, you know, very nihilistic, a sort of forgetting of the George Floyd uprising, you know, and a sort of mass kind of hardening against the fact, the ongoing fact of death, mass death, you know,
right.
A failure to grieve, which is the only way you process and integrate the knowledge of this kind of loss. And, our collective kind of implicatedness in the unnecessariness, you know, the brutal, almost unfaceable kind of like unnecessariness of all this death, you know, and our collective kind of co-responsibility for the world that produced it.
I want to see every fucking person here moving to this next song, all right? We came here to have a good time. I want to see everyone dancing here. Don't be shy. Are you ready? Have a good team.
God!
The Final Straw is a proud member of the Channel Zero Network of Anarchist Podcasts.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that, nihilism is really apparent, especially in the kind of, like, right-wing reactions that, like, took the opportunity to attack the idea of, like, being taught about racism or being exposed to queerness and other, and basically other family structures.
Well, youth liberation and children's liberation are, you know, concepts that, or is a concept that almost, I feel, people have heard of even less than abolition of the family somehow. Like, because, you know, sometimes people have heard of, like, smash the church, smash the state, smash the family, you know, those three used to go together a little bit in, you know, gay liberation histories. So, but children's liberation and the analysis of sort of adult supremacy are, yeah, those are sort of currently cultivated, I think, only among anarchists in the, as far as I can see, in the United States, for example. There's a really great collection coming out that came out from AK Press by Carla Bergman that's called Trust Kids, which has, you know, stories about confronting adult supremacy and trying to, in small, necessarily kind of relatively sort of voluntarist or certainly small scale ways, kind of trying to develop different, you know, radical democracies transgenerationally. I mean, I do think that for me, abolition of the family is very much about a sort of radicalization. Well, I don't know if I really feel attached to the word democracy, but the idea of a sort of truly, you know, de-hierarchized space of negotiation over care, you know, so elderly people and very young people currently are positioned in our society culturally and socially very much at a disadvantage because of their relation to the workplace, right? So when capitalism is not yet able to use you for the production of surplus value because you're too young or you're too old and you've been used up, or because you've been classified as, you know, disabled, you know, disability can be, you know, thought of as a form of inutility, like unusefulness to capital, right? And in that sense, there's quite a lot of similarity and overlap between youth liberation and disability liberation, although I think some people find that quite startling and, you know, want to kind of hit back and say, are you saying that disabled people are like children, right? Which is like, well, no. And also, you know, do you think that children are not people? Like,
right. Why is that a bad thing?
Yeah. But, yeah, I think the history of sort of experiments in children's autonomy and sort of equality with adults is, you know, quite easily criticized from a sort of like, you know, Marxist or revolutionary perspective because of that they're so piecemeal. Often it was quite small projects, like fee-paying schools even, right? So they're really not even outside of, you know, like marketized education, for example, right? Like there was a school called Summerhill that was quite famous, and it was like it was in England. I think it began in the 40s or even 30s. I can't remember. But it became sort of famous in the 60s. It ran for a long time. Summerhill was a kind of radical educators project. And, you know, parents sent children there and paid fees, right? But while they were at Summerhill, there was all this radical pedagogy that was being put into place with sort of total horizontality and around decision-making. Well, that was the theory, and people sort of poked holes in it and said, well, no, I mean, you know, the schoolmaster, in a sense, is still a schoolmaster. He still, like, you know, pays the, you know, the taxes on the property and it's that, you know, lots of people were really, like, keen to sort of, like, poke holes in it from all directions, and certainly it was, like, you know, it was ultimately, like, a private school, right? But it was also an anti-school. There was a principle of sort of the only classes that people took were the classes that they wanted to take, and they were not obliged to do anything at any point. Things like bedtimes and so on were all, like, you know, collectively decided. And I really found it quite delightful reading some of the negotiations, some of the accounted meetings. And I mean, you know, because we live in this world, it was always kind of asked, you know, could the children who came through Summerhill get jobs? Yeah, in the normal world. And the answer to that was always like, yeah. In fact, actually, yeah, they were, you know, creative individuals who excelled at whatever, you know, vocation they decided to study in the end, because they really wanted to study. Sometimes, apparently, young people would not do sort of classes or schooling for like 2 years at a time before they felt any desire to, because they were so kind of burned and traumatized from the world of sort of hierarchized schooling that they had left in order to come to Summerhill. And then they would actually decide, no, I do want to learn engineering, and then whatever, you know. Inspiring as a tiny little glimpse into what might conceivably be possible in terms of relations between the young and the not so young, I guess. Like, I, even though with all the caveats I've already kind of given, I'm in a way more inspired by the sorts of youth-led or youth-run sorts of collectives and social centers that are talked about in, like, the Purple Thistle in Vancouver. Is the subject of some of Carla Bergman's writings, for example, and that perhaps a more I don't think it necessarily, you know, has some of the same utopian aspirations of some of the kind of radical pedagogues such as, you know, A.F. Neil of Summerhill in the 60s and 70s, but in many ways it's more true to its own form because of its attention to the actual voices and thoughts and writings of, you know, of actual children or young people who, you know, may or may not actually share the same sorts of, like, youth or children's liberationist, like, ideas that people, like that I do, right? And you run into these sorts of, you know, paradoxes and problems when you try and liberate people against their will in the abstract level of theory, you know.
Oh!
like there's a contribution by Carla Bergman's comrade or kid who isn't really sure about the idea that children do not belong to anyone, right? Which is a sort of phrase and a concept that comes up in a poem famously by Khalil Gibran, you know, your children are not your children. They are the sons and the daughters of life's longing for itself. And, you know, there's a sort of commentary on that by a teenager who isn't sure it sounds good to them. The idea that children don't belong to anyone but themselves or belong to all of us equally as a responsibility, as a care necessity, was very popular among, you know, Black and sort of so-called third worldist liberationist, Black and sort of third world gay and lesbian conferences in the 70s often, you know, caucused to the effect that, like, children must be liberated not just from the patriarchy but also from the sort of ownership model of parenthood full stop. So even sort of like lesbian parents, for example, would say, like, we're not trying to mimic the proprietary structures of patriarchal parenthood in our own lesbian communities. We want to completely revolutionize the whole concept of parenthood and the private-public distinction altogether. But then again, you kind of need a model for how children who have entitlement and means to very specific forms of care that often need to be very, like, especially for the very early years of a human life, very stable, you know, to some extent. In some forms, they have to be very, very reliable arrangements of care provision and delivery, you know, to extremely young people. Although it's not clear that it has to be the same exact adults at all. You know, it could be several. But, you know, you have to come up with sort of maybe, like, imaginings, I think, for what the model might be. And so for that reason, it's nice to visit speculative fictions or science fictions like Marge Piercy's Woman on the Edge of Time, where there's a society called Mattapoisett. I think she wrote this in 1976. She was influenced by Shulamith Firestone's, you know, Dialectic of Sex, with its, you know, its ambivalent openness to the possibility that some forms of technology could help liberate proletarian sort of gestators, like pregnant people, from the burden of necessary compulsory pregnancy if they want it. And that's very much in a post-capitalist scenario rather than the present scenario of, you know, techno-patriarchal capitalist sort of evil, where she is very clear, like, if something like an artificial womb were to be developed, it would be a nightmare. It would be for all the wrong reasons and with all the wrong consequences, which is indeed how ectogenetic, as it's known, ectogenetic technology is being developed right now by people with very strong sort of pro-life commitments and fetal personhood commitments.
This concludes part one of The Antisocial Family by Sophie Lewis from You've Been Listening to Sepultura live at Hellfest 2022. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G.
If you would like to support The Final Straw, you can subscribe to our podcast via various platforms, follow and share our materials online, as well as give us feedback via the links at tfsr.wtf/tree, as in Linktree. To support our transcription work and wider project, you can subscribe to us via patreon.com/tfsr. You can also buy some merch or find donation methods at tfsr.wtf/support.
This is The Final Straw. This show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions and suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net or thefinalstrawradio@protonmail.com. If you'd like to use any episode for your project or radio show, feel free to do so. Just send us an email to let us know. If you care to, you can send us letters at The Final Straw Radio, P.O. Box 6004, Asheville, North Carolina, 28816. This show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee. Located at 610 Haywood Road, Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned co-op in Asheville specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. You can find a catalog of Firestorm's books and zines, plus a full calendar of events up at their website, firestorm.coop.
This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. Tonight we'll have a broadcast from Final Straw Radio by Sophie Lewis and her book, The Antisocial Family. Talk about the private nuclear family, children's liberation in 2022 as a result of the COVID pandemic, caring for children and the disabled, and the movement for family liberation against capitalist privatization. A new look at the old system of matriarchal familyhood. Music by Sepultura, a metal band from Brazil, from this summer's performance at Hellfest 2022. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G.
In this kind of speculative fiction where working class gestators, pregnant people, have thought about their needs for gestationally assistive technology, there's a kind of, there's a communal tank with fetuses, and after the fetuses are kind of finished gestating in this, you know, mechanical brooder, as it's called, the community parents, according to a sort of three-tier system where there's like an expert called a kid binder who is sort of professionally like given over to the vocation of looking after kids because it's a serious business, it's a serious art, you know, so there's like people like that, like who are kid binders, parents for all the children in the community. And then everybody else is also responsible at the same time. And then the third kind of level is that every single individual child has three designated parents. So there's kind of those three levels. And I quite like those concrete proposals because it kind of gives your mind something to like to work with, you know. And if you know children and can talk to them about what they think about that, I think, you know, you can kind of advance a little bit into a less abstract level of, like, children's liberationism in 2022.
But then, you know, that, like, reaction that you mentioned of, like, well, I'm not so sure that's such a good thing, like, that speaks to another desire, I think, that could get lost in some of the discussions about, like, wanting to be cared for.
Mm-hmm.
And like what the distinction is between like wanting to be cared for and like wanting someone to have power over you, you know, because like in both of the situations of caring for children or caring for, you know, sick or disabled people, that can be transformed into power and control. And that's what the right wing like literally calls it in terms of parental rights. But there's another kind of care that doesn't totally destroy your autonomy. And I think maybe it's hard to see that from our perspective now, right? Even maybe our desires, because we're so exhausted of caring for ourselves, that the desire to be cared for might be some kind of totalizing desire that just like an escape, you know? But maybe like to phrase that as a question, how do you think family abolition could, the idea of family abolition or the movement for it could transform our understanding of care? You know, along the lines of like Federici saying, we don't even know what love is because of being forced to do this for as work. You know, what is the kind of utopian vision of care that comes from family abolition perspective?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think a part of me is content to tolerate not fully knowing and being up for finding out along the way, because I think definitionally it. Some part of it can't be known in advance, and it would be a little bit like that very moving sort of line of thought that you're citing or gesturing towards kind of implies, like, you know, we want to find out what it would be like to conduct these same labors, you know, these beautiful moments that are beautiful, again, even in the present, where they are stolen from us in large part. Not 100%, but a large part of these sorts of creativities and affects are kind of like being expropriated by capital from under our noses. Nevertheless, we experience some of the nicest, most pleasurable, joyous, you know, liberated feelings while, you know, like teaching a very young person how to speak or learning things back from them. You know, what do we learn from one another transgenerationally or just in general, you know, in a, like it's there's the worst and the best of life, I think, in the sort of, you know, contemporary organization of like maternal drudgery, for example, you know, like wiping a child's nose, as I sort of said earlier, you know, like every day on your own with no assistance is a bit of a living hell, but at the same time, you know, the relationship with that same child might be giving you some of the, you know, the best ideas, the most sort of nurturant feelings and so on and so forth, right? But we want to find out what it would be like to not have that whole situation circumscribed by capitalist privatization.
Oh,
such that the sort of the isolated intensity of that sort of codependence, really, like, because in a weird way, parents are almost, I'm not going to say equally, but like similarly dependent on the children who are so sort of totally dependent on them for their care and survival, because of the way that your whole identity as a worker would kind of fall apart if you were not the exclusive sort of authority, the quasi-exclusive authority and bearer of responsibility over that child's, you know, existence, right? And so you would have to find out, and this is the kind of curiosity that Federici and her comrades were talking about, like, have to find out what it would be like to love freely, you know, truly freely. Mm-hmm. And so care, as you say, in the present is often sort of bound up in power and powerlessness. It's often a kind of, and I'm not sure that it never intersects with autonomy in a somewhat constraining way. Like, I don't know. We will find out, like, whether care and autonomy can be, you know, interlaced with no friction, you know. Mm-hmm. I wonder. I think that's the question, right? My definition of love is about both care and autonomy, right? To love someone is to struggle, to strive for their immersion in care, like maximum abundant care, at the same time, you know, as having maximum autonomy. And I don't know the extent to which those two things in, you know, futurely might rub up against one another, but love is so proprietary in the present. You know, we don't really want people to be loved by others. Like, I think some of us do. I mean, and maybe all of us, you know, somewhat do at our best moments, right? But because of the kind of enforced scarcity of care, the care crisis of capitalism, or the care crisis that is capitalism, that capitalism is, like, we don't, you know, we don't feel it's safe, right? We don't trust ourselves or others to be cared for by many, or indeed to be autonomous from us. But I hope and believe, and to an extent I know, that it can be otherwise, and that the sort of enthusiasm and excitement for those anti-proprietary, anti-possessive sort of modes can spread like wildfire in moments of high-intensity struggle, or in moments of kind of mass occupation of public space where things kind of stay and develop and become creative, become experimental. People live together in moments of sort of insurgency. You know, somehow I think the proprietary logic of our emotion, you know, what Alva Gottbee calls our emotional reproduction of one another and ourselves on these like proprietarian lines, is weakened and loosened, and like a kind of red love, as Alexander Kollontai called it, becomes a bit more palpable. Well, I mean, Mark Fisher also, I'm not sure he's down for a family abolition at all, but he has a nice phrase, red plenty, you know? And I think the sort of emotional level of red plenty is where we feel secure in the kind of contingency of our caring and cared for-ness. We don't need containers like the family, like marriage, like private property to reassure us that we will be held tomorrow as well as today. And indeed, you know, those containers that I just mentioned, you know, family and the sort of the mechanisms that come along with it, like inheritance and so on and so forth, and marriage and so on, they are already like quite fallible. You know, they kind of, yeah, they do fulfill certain social reproductive functions kind of adequately from capitalism's point of view. You know, from our point of view, it's like, well, you know, if your husband walks out on you, everyone knows a husband can walk out on you, right? Like, mm-hmm. In fact, marriage doesn't actually, like, or like a wife can walk out on you. Although statistically that happens less, which is curious. Like, you know, I'm just sorry, but I'm going too many parentheses deep right now. But I thank you.
Are you people ready to do this? So many good bands playing today. Are you guys tired? No? Let's do this, people! Let's go.
Like, I keep noticing that the kind of conversation about the crisis of, like, white masculinity in America doesn't really, like, refer to the ample evidence, like, the sociology that shows that, like, you know, men benefit massively from heterosexual marriage, right? Even with all their complaints and, like, oh, you know, like, yeah, there's no male breadwinner household anymore and, you know, whatever. Like, women aren't, like, respecting men anymore. The whatever narrative is being peddled by Jordan Peterson, basically. But, like, the hard evidence is basically, like, yeah, you know, marriage is a great deal for men, you know? Like,
right.
It's a great labor deal for heterosexual men, and that's why they don't leave marriages. They cheat, but they don't leave. Anyway.
One of the things that you said that's really important that comes in feminist and gay liberation texts from the 70s is this idea that the family gives to the worker this like mini hierarchy, right? Like, you get yelled at by your boss at work, but you come home and you get to lord it over your wife and children. And then, you know, there's a chain of hierarchy there too, where the, like, the husband has power over the wife, but the wife maybe has power over the children. It's, you know, it's the little laboratory and, like, learning your place. And then also, I guess, like, the kind of violent pleasures of having power over someone, too. I think that's really an important thing to pull out. And also, like, that's how I sort of try to explain to myself this current movement of, like, you know, in the moment of, like, devastation and economic precarity for so many people, why there's, like, a parental rights movement, you know, like, why is that the thing? It's like, that's one place where you these people are, you know, like, naturalized into having power over someone where they have no power in any other situation, perhaps.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Like, there's something I literally thought just a minute before getting on this podcast with you, Scott, which was someone shared a snippet of Hannah Arendt, who is a philosopher I've always kind of disliked, and very, very conservative. It's always surprised me that that's not just, like, you know, established as, you know, what Arendt is, you know, a conservative philosopher, in my opinion, anyway. But yeah, there was a sort of section of an essay by her that I'd never read, which was her essay opposing desegregation.
Oh, yeah.
And as I say, I didn't even know that. But she argues that it is too great of an infringement on parental rights, basically, to demand that children go to desegregated schools if their parents don't want to sort of, like, create a desegregated family culture, right? So, like, she has this kind of, yeah, fantastically clear and strong statement in favor of, like, the primacy of family, i.e. parental authority over the realm of the public. So, like, she, I don't know if this is actually useful, and you may want to cut this from the recording, but I was just, like, thinking about the social crisis that she was sort of writing from within, like, the tumult, like, you know, we have, like, yeah, she's writing from this moment of, like, yeah, like, racial justice upheaval and movement, right? And she's saying the family is threatened by this, and I choose to uphold the family. You know, you can't. I think we need to get braver, especially if you want to create a sort of comparison. I don't know, like, maybe I'm being too bold here, but I think there are sort of similarities, really, like, in this moment of sort of organized assault on trans children and trans life more generally. Like, do people have the guts to understand the structure, like, the way in which the far right is sometimes onto something when it accuses anti-capitalists, feminists, leftists, of seeking to undermine the sanctity of the family?
Mm-hmm.
Are we, like, they are not exactly wrong about that. Like, we do, against Arendt, for example, insist that parental rights can go get fucked. Like,
yeah.
When it comes to, well, you know, in my opinion, most things, but certainly when it comes to kind of white supremacist mores and views, you know, when it comes to the right of children to access healthcare that they need, be that, to be honest, like vaccinations, right? Like these anti-vax moms who want to put like oil on the on young people who need antibiotics, right? That's a sort of pet peeve of mine. Or or who want to prevent young people from determining their own gender affirming healthcare pathways, right? Like, I think the missing part of left discourse is, in a sense, the willingness to say, yeah, we do oppose the family on these fronts, right? Or even criticize it, right? We do not consider parental rights like a supreme value in this terrain, right? And you have to be very clear that at the same time as saying that, you know, you can very well and must and should oppose the kind of devaluation and dehumanization of black parents, for example, whose parental rights are, you know, always already null and void to a certain extent within the child protective services industry, you know. Well, null and void is an overstatement, but, you know, Dorothy Roberts has important scholarship on family policing and the, you know, the very, very white supremacist structure of parenthood in law and in, you know, child protection generally. So you can, according to her, you know, and I agree, you know, seek to abolish family policing and to that extent basically argue almost for the the voices of black parents to count more, while at the same time, you know, fighting for family abolition in a long-term way and for parental rights to be very sort of limited compared to the sort of rights of children, or like balanced out, you know, relative to the rights of children.
Never give up.
But family abolition is full of these sorts of slightly tricky to think through on the face of them sort of contradictions, right? Because we live in a world in which family is always already a sort of racially bifurcated technology, right? Which is not to say that, like, yeah, that black or racialized or immigrant or queer or proletarian working class sort of families aren't part of the privatization of care into private households, which for me is the main thing about the family. And so even these sorts of alternative forms of household and social reproduction and kinship that in many ways have skills and experiences that are going to be super useful for family abolitionism, it kind of makes no sense to sort of, you know, make exceptions for these sorts of marginalized and underserved and under, you know, benefited families, like, by which I mean, like, people who benefit the least really from the edifice of family values and the regime of familism as an economic system, saying like, oh, we don't mean those families, we just mean like the white bourgeois family, right? Which on some level people always want me to say. They want me to specify, like, when I say family abolition, I mean the white bourgeois family. But I think if you define the family, as I think it is correct to do, as a mechanism that really affects everybody and is reproduced, you know, not wittingly or not, by everyone, then you really have to, you know, be talking about the privatization of care and how, yeah, in a way, the non-bourgeois, non-white, you know, non-settler families are going to benefit the most from family abolition. And in that sense, you know, deserve it the most and, you know, should not be exceptionalized or, for that matter, romanticized, right? Because, yeah, the private nuclear household is not somehow, like, a wonderful thing just because it happens to be, you know, situated in a, you know, a racialized, proletarianized community.
This next song is called Propaganda! We'll be right back. Merci beaucoup.
It's really interesting. I mean, the collapse of that imaginary at the height of the struggles that proliferated around 1970, you know, is definitely linked to, yeah, simply the, you know, the material defeat, you know, the murder, frankly, and repression that the state, you know, successfully carried out. Well, it was eventually successful, you know, in carrying out, you know, our people were stomped into the dust, and like we can't really state that enough. Like I think you can look at the beginning of the 70s and the end of the 70s and almost compare the text. I found two things that it kind of struck me were sort of almost amazingly different, you know. Oh, I guess it's like the early 70s and the early 80s. Like a text by Pat Parker, who is a sort of Oakland-based black liberationist, radical nurse, and third world kind of feminist who, you know, has a a speech that she gave at a sort of anti-imperialist convergence that is all about how white women on the left need to get with the program of family abolition and stop being scared because capitalism and the state will not fall until women and children explode the cell of the family, of the private nuclear household. And so that text is kind of amazing because it puts black women really squarely at the sort of at the forefront, really, of that politics, which I personally, until I looked in the archive, kind of imagined, like everybody else kind of imagined, was, you know, probably most forcefully articulated by, you know, the white Jewish feminist Shulamith Firestone. You know, it's just not the case, actually. Black women were saying it way harder, mm-hmm. As I discovered. But then, you know, 10 years later, and, you know, you think of all the kind of successful state repression of black liberationist struggle in the interim, you have Hazel Carby's very famous and also very well articulated, almost like open letter, White Woman Listen. I think that's from 1984, and it's basically about white feminists' excessive emphasis on the family as an oppressive structure. And she sort of says, black feminists do not deny that the family can be a source of oppression, but it's also an important site of survival and resistance to the state for us, right? And that's the text that everybody knows, by the way, right? They don't know the previous one, the 10 years before that, because, as I say, the memory has been kind of erased. But I find it so interesting that sort of, you know, that essentially we're kind of talking about, you know, the defeat of black feminist, you know, abolitionism in the widest sense. Right, the abolitionism of the present state of things in its entirety, right? Family, capital, state, you know, criminal justice system, all of it. Like that intensity was actually voiced by the black feminist imaginary, which kind of makes sense given, you know, for example, Hortense Spiller's analysis of how it is the black woman who falls out of the symbolic logics of, you know, gendered humanness in the grammar of American life. And it is the sort of black female social subject who needs to be made a place for, right? We don't know what that place would be. Would that be, she says she doesn't know whether that place would be like called a family anymore.
Right.
That's possible. Tiffany Letabo King reads Hortense Spiller's sort of epochal text, like Mama's Baby, Papa's Maybe, as potentially family abolitionist. And Tiffany Letabo King is one of the, you know, black family abolitionist theorists thinking and, you know, working today. And she's not the only one, you know. I quote Lola Olufemi and Annie Olaloku Tariba, who's working on patriarchal motherhood from a sort of black radical perspective in the UK right now in my little book as well. I do think maybe it is, you know, it is the defeat of black power that you can almost point to explain why family abolitionism was no longer thinkable by the end of the 70s.
This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. This concludes our two-part episode on The Antisocial Family, written by Sophie Lewis. We thank our friends at Final Straw Radio for this broadcast. We hope you enjoyed it. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G.
This is The Final Straw. This show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions and suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net or thefinalstrawradio@protonmail.com. If you'd like to use any episode for your project or radio show, feel free to do so. Just send us an email to let us know.
This concludes part one of the Abolitionist Hour. You've been listening to Sophie Lewis and her book, The Antisocial Family. Disgust.
government had an idea and Parliament made it law. Seems like it's illegal to fight for the union anymore. And which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Set off to join the picket lines, but together we cannot fail. We got stopped by police at the county line. They said, go on, boys, or you'll go into jail. And which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Well, it's hard to explain to a crying child why her daddy won't go back. So the family suffer, but it hurts me more to hear a scab say, sod you, Jack. Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? I'm bound to follow my conscience, and I'll do whatever I can. But it'll take much more than a union law to knock the fight out of a working man. And which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on?